So yesterday, we tried to look at the outside and more superficial polarization between the teachings of Gurdjieff and Teilhard that sort of reduces them to the slogan of opposites. Teilhardian optimism and Gurdjieffian pessimism. And you can see if you look a little bit harder that both of these are, with that same kind of superficial and external brush, pegged to the timeline. We see in the typical picture Teilhard glibly marching to the future, onward and upward. From the future we will be saved. So, and that map just just sort of is steeped with the kind of cheerful positivism, onward and upward. Progress in the human sphere is progress in the divine sphere. And this is really the kind of superficial interpretation that people will lay on Teilhard. In the same way, but at the opposite end of the spectrum, Gurdjieff is often superficially painted as the one who seeks refuge in the past. That this world has gone to hell in a handbasket. We're just drifted farther and farther away from something we once knew, and now we've lost it, and that we have to look backward, back in time, to the primitive societies, to the more profound understandings of human purpose that are now lost in our culture. That dimension is certainly there and has been given unusual prominence in the modern kind of placement of the Gurdjieffian teaching. Particularly in Parabola magazine and in some of the traditionalist interpretations of him that say that he's anti-modernist and that therefore he's looking for a glorified society at the origin. Well, it's true that both he and Teilhard have powerfully in common that they're looking for renewal at the point of origin. But what people fail to notice from the perspectival thinking of the rational mind is that origin is not a point of the timeline. Okay. Is that clear for you? Any of you who've preached the Gospel of John know all about that. In Arche, in the beginning. But what is the beginning? The beginning is not the point in time at which the timeline starts. The beginning is the original impulse, the dough, as Gurdjieff would call it, that starts a new octave, that sends it out in concentric waves related to that stronger point of originality, or in other words, ever-resulting newness, which does not lie on the timeline and cannot be captured by either end of it. It lies at a different level of perception, at a different level of consciousness. As we've been playing with the Gebser maps, we would call in the a-perspectival realm, in that which is beyond the conditions of time. And so the moment you put either Teilhard or Gurdjieff on a linear timeline, you've reduced their teaching almost beyond recognition. And it's no wonder that the scholars, quote, the so-called learned beings of the new formation are consistently missing both Gurdjieff and Teilhard, because they don't grasp that the origin that these two men are both pointing to is outside of time, but inside of everything. And if you go back to the title of Gebser's book, The Ever-Present Origin, that seemed like a strange title. But this has been a mystical insight that's there at a certain level of thinking from the beginning, not thinking but perception from the beginning, that the origin is sealed in our own hearts, like the chiastic center of our own life. And while you can't see it with your day vision, let me look at my origin, see what, let's get all my characteristics from my origin, maybe I'll know what Enneagram type I really am. No, it doesn't work that way. But you can coexist with your origin at point of origin, and you can flow out from your origin and what will be perceived both inwardly and outwardly as authentic being, if you can if you could find your way to that which is really in your own heart. So we're going to look at it from that perspective. Let's forget timelines. Gurdjieff was not looking backwards. Teilhard was not looking forwards. They were both looking outward into a new dimension, which was beginning to rise amidst all the other junk and desecration and chaos of the early 20th century, was beginning to rise there as well, in such a way that it began to have some heft. So what I want to do this morning is to come back to the thesis that Teilhard was actually an early aperspectival thinker. You know, that Gebser would call him an early mutation, because in Gebser's wonderful theory of things, the new paradigm that begins to emerge, the new structure of consciousness, is not linear. You know, it doesn't happen gradually that every year there's a 20% increase in the number of people that are going to do it. It appears, it disappears, it appears, it disappears. It seems to communicate by non-localized action. It's here, and then it's in South Africa, and then it's somewhere else, and then it goes away, and then it's back. And what you begin to see is increasing clusters of people thinking this way. So Teilhard was an early mutation, an early sign in the philosophical traditions of the West, that a new room in the mansion was about to unfold in the great museum, a new structure of consciousness, a perspective. And I want to call attention to a few paragraphs, particularly in The Human Phenomenon, that gives some indication of that. And part of the quandary, the dilemma for Teilhard, and a dilemma which is still not solved, if anything, it's compounded in the 50 years or so since he's died, 60 now, is the fact that you know, he's really, I call him a ternary swan in a binary duck pond. When I wrote about him in an article I did for Ilya Delio a few years ago, that he had a very, very strong taste of this new dimension entering, but the structures and the maps that he had at his disposal, and the formation that he had not only by his own training as a scholar, a scientist, and a Jesuit, but also in his bloodline. He's a blood relative of Voltaire and the whole great French philosophical tradition. So he's a consummately formed mental, rational thinker. And what causes the hiccups in Teilhard's thinking cannot be spotted by the academic establishment today, which is still enchained to the same, you know, final gasps of the mental rational model. And what we were trying to lay out last, you know, at the beginning several millennia ago, is that even with great, you know, self-importance, the integral era as heralded by Ken Wilber and others still can't spot it, because they're trapped on the same back. You know, as long as they can only see the structures of consciousness as linear steps on a ladder to some higher goal yet to reveal itself in time, they're in the same mess. And so we still don't have filters for appraising Teilhard from where he really is. You have to have a little bit of a sense of where this is going. You have to have moved beyond this, a little bit beyond the sleep, the waking sleep we talked about yet, to an inner glimmer of what this awakening is before you can see the problem even, much less begin to spot the way out. So for me, the real key to following Teilhardian thought is to ask the question that got asked to me thrillingly during my dozen years or so of very painful formation, which means unformation in the work. Did you actually see that, or were you thinking it? And the greatest insight in the work, and not in the work alone, but in this whole band of great, you know, multidimensional thinking, is that thinking is not an early stage of seeing. It's an entirely different mechanism, and thinking blocks seeing. It substitutes a slow, deductive, linear, time-bound, sequential approach to things, to what is actually grasped instantly at a different level. Once it's grasped, then you can use your thinking to orchestrate. But rationality as a tool to insight ain't gonna work. And it takes a long, long time. And since we've been trained in our culture with a sort of pathetic over-reliance on linear thinking, we don't see the blind spot. So I'm going to try and collect a set of clues today that suggest that Teilhard actually knew this, not consistently, but he knew this. And that you can tell if you read sensitively in his work when he's seeing and when he's thinking. And I'm going to poke a little bit into the suggestion as well that the capacity to see directly and not just think really depends on the engagement of a new center of perception in you. That as long as you're using your mind as the source of your interpretive methodology, you're going to be, as Gurdjieff would say, stuck in one center. And it's not a center that can see. Sorry. So it's the engagement of another faculty. We looked at it in Gurdjieffian categories yesterday as the balancing, the engagement, and then the balancing of the three lower centers, so that it forms a stable platform that something else can and will enter. The classic way of describing that in the Eastern Orthodox tradition is putting the mind in the heart, which doesn't get you the moving center and other things like that, but it does begin to approximate that the shift from thinking to seeing is not going to happen just by thinking in a more refined way. It's going to happen when a new center kicks in. And if you really want to break into this other space, forget perfecting thinking. Concentrate instead on nurturing the emergence of this other. Does that make sense? So a couple little windows, first of all, into Teilhard's thinking. And I'm going to say that basically the two places where I think he's most trustworthily thinking or seeing is in his, paradoxically, his great vision that cosmogenesis is Christogenesis. Or in other words, that Christ is at the heart of evolution, directing from the center out. I think he's actually seeing that, not intuiting that. And I'm going to try and lay out why I think that's the case. And that therefore, in a really deep way, it's trustworthy. I think the other place where he's seeing very clearly, although he doesn't know what he's seeing, is he's seeing the lineaments of what Gurdjieff would call intentional suffering as the path to getting there. And he's seeing it not just by expounding pretty hymns and essays on it, but by incarnating it in his own life. So I want to touch just on those. But first of all, I've alluded before to this extraordinary prologue to the human phenomenon, which you really can't translate into English because of the way infinitives work in English, you know, to see, to, you know. In most other languages, it's just a single word. And in French, it is voir, see. It's not, you know, and we have to say either to see or seeing, and either one we can say. There's a sub striking, like the shaft of it. And it's about a 3-page introduction, but he starts with a really strong see or perish. Voir ou périr, you know, that he's not messing around with this. The theme of seeing is going to bookend everything he writes. You know, as if he's trying to cry from some deeper recess in his heart that some other faculty of perception is kicking in, something that he has no idea how to name, but remains true to nonetheless. So this is the prologue is particularly is worthy of Lectio Divina, I think. If you want to take it, the whole of human phenomenon works really, really well for Lectio Divina. You know, that I've sort of put the Bible on hold for a while and read the human phenomenon because I get such a profound insight into the heart and soul of this planet that we're living in. Anyway, he has an interesting comment. The chapter is all about perspective. And he has this paragraph that has arrested me for 5 years or more now, on page 4 in the book, where he's talking about perspective. It is only normal, but confining, for us to have to carry with us, wherever we go, the center of the landscape we are passing through. But what would happen to us walking if the chances of our journey brought us to a naturally advantageous panoramic point, an intersection of roads or valleys from which not only our eyes looked out, but from which things themselves radiate? Then, as the subjective point of view coincided with the objective distribution of things, perception would be established in its fullness. The landscape would become legible and illuminated from within. We would see. Now, this paragraph has got enough in it to chew on for a month. And one of the things that is fascinating at it is it's working on two levels at once. And it can be interpreted on either level and it'll hold together. So he starts with a kind of fresh assumption anyway. It's normal but confining for us to have to carry with us wherever we go the center of the landscape we are passing through. In other words, you know, because of the structure of the consciousness we're using, we are always the center of whatever circle of perception we are. We always say, I am looking at this. You're the point, it's the radius. And so he's already kind of picking up that the subject-object polarity is implicit in the structures of perception and in the field of perception we pick up. You can't see beyond your own event horizon in a kind of funny way. And then this intriguing next sentence, but what would happen to us walking if the chances of our journey brought us to a naturally advantageous panoramic point, an intersection of roads or valleys from which not only our eyes looked out, but from which things themselves radiate? Well, what makes that sentence interesting to me is that you could take it at the level of self-reflective consciousness and make it make sense. So you're walking along, and you're just in the middle of your valley or wherever, and you climb up onto a hill. And all of a sudden, from that perspective, you see a little bit more of the picture. You've elevated your perspective. And if you happen to be in a place like the front range of the Colorado Rockies where I saw, you can see from your slightly higher point the headwaters of the four great rivers that flow out there. So in that sense, you're seeing the place where things actually emerge from. So in that sense, you can make sense of this comment still using the self-reflective mechanism. It's like, oh yeah, he's just talking about you're seeing the headwaters of the streams, you're seeing, and that's because it's higher. But from another point of view, this would be an exact description of the ever-present origin. That in this world, things are flowing out, things as they actually are, flow out from another world, from another dimension of causality. As we talked about it, origin is not on the timeline. And whether you call it imaginal, causal, that the actual concrete origin of things is at a different level, is at it in a different dimension. And what trickles down in this, you know, is the contrails of something that actually has its point of origin in a deeper dimensionality. And I'm saying that very calculatedly that way, rather than in another dimension, which gets everybody scurrying off to find the right room that has the control switch in it. You know, it's a whole different structuring of consciousness, not the treasure house of our present state of consciousness. So he's describing the flow. Remember that wonderful quote from Black Elk? I looked about me and saw just then, looked at what we were doing and saw that what we were doing was like a shadow cast on earth from yonder vision in the heaven. So bright it was, so clear. Mm-hmm. And I knew that the real was yonder and the darkened dream of it is here. That shocking sense that we are the tail of a dog of a far greater reality that's wagging from way deeper than, you know, we can see. It's a wake-up itself. And I think he's really alluding to that. And what he says then is that then as the subjective point of view coincided with the objective distribution of things, perception would be established. In other words, seeing rather than just thinking has something to do with this this conventional, constructed polarization of perception into subject-object, which we use to get around in this life. It is the hardwiring of mental rational consciousness and therefore of our Western culture. But it's what gets in the way, it's what traps us in thinking rather than allowing us to directly proceed to seeing. And he understands that somehow subjective and objective have to fold back together in a way that preserves awareness, but without the self-reflective mechanism. So he at least grasped that. I think this is a fascinating passage. Then he goes on a couple of paragraphs later to talk about these new sort of scales and dimensions of seeing that we need to navigate even what science has now laid before us as a much more realistic appraisal of the actual space-time dimensions of the created universe. And he says, we need the sense of spatial immensity, the immensely great and the immensely small, disarticulating and spacing out the circles of objects rushing toward us at the interior of a sphere with an indefinite radius. We need a sense of depth, laboriously pushing back events in an endless series over immeasurable temporal distances. The sense of number, discovering and assessing with open eyes the staggering multitude of material or living elements. The sense of proportion, somehow realizing the difference in physical scale that separates the dimensions and rhythms of the atom from the nebula and the infinitesimal from the immense. The sense of movement, capable of perceiving the irresistible developments hidden in the immensely slow, the extreme agitation concealed under a veil of repose. The wholly new slipping into the heart of the monotonous repetition of the same thing. Do you notice that in virtually all of those characteristics, he's talking about a simultaneity, what we would call in work terminology expanded attention, that you need to be able to register simultaneously and harmoniously different scales, different tempos. How does it go? You know, both of them moving in their perfect coherence and order. And something in us has to be able to contribute them. So what's interesting in this chart, for me anyway, is not just that he's calling us, okay, blow it out, boys. Let's see that it isn't a young Earth 11,000 years old. Let's see that it's, you know, he's not just stretching it out to the boundaries. He's insisting that at the same time you stretch it out to the boundaries, that you don't lose track of the infinitely particular. And in this, he's also strongly suggesting that it's that faculty in us, and only that faculty, that is eventually going to be able to reconcile the apparent polarization between the whole and the part. Okay? You know, and this has been a lifelong question for him. How can I become one with the universe without being dissolved in it so that I lose my identity? And he's not willing to lose his particularity because he finds that as the basic evolutionary tension. It's resolved at a different level. It can't be resolved in philosophy. It has to be resolved in the fact that, yeah, they just exist. The two scales exist as powerfully as your two arms moving in different tempos. It's just that the mind you're currently using won't grasp it. And finally, he adds then, finally, the sense of the organic, discovering the physical bonds and structural unity beneath the superficial juxtapositions of successions, temporal moments, and collectivities. So this deep yearning for the sense of the whole, a oneness that doesn't cancel particularity, but in some sense incorporates it within an even deeper sphere of perception. This is almost a textbook description of what Gebser would name as the capacities of aperspectival consciousness. It's also kind of interesting what I list as the characteristics of imaginal causality. The capacity to see, you know, particularly to use time in a whole different way, not as a metronome, but as a volume in an arrangement which is spatial running at different scales. So all of these things suggest to me his profound intimations of what this thinking is and how he's actually coming to it. So with that as the backdrop, I want to turn to his most powerful assertion. The one that everybody thinks is nuts is that the universe evolution does have a trajectory, and not only that, there's a master holding the reins, and that master is Christ, continuous in all realms with the human Jesus, and who has assumed the conscious lordship of evolution to pull all into, as it says in the Bible, into subjection under your Christ, and thence to give it all back to God, so that God shall be all in all. These wonderful, lofty words that come to us from St. Paul's highest visions in his contributions and his epistles. But this was Teilhard's. Teilhard is like Paul reborn. Mm-hmm. He sees it. And most people just say, okay, you know, that's he stopped thinking like a scientist there. He's just put on his cap as a mystic, and he's just spouting this rhetorical pablum, and I as a good modernist and postmodernist thinker can just say, oh well, he became a silly old man and he abandoned his scientific training. Not so. At least in my estimation, not so. The very last work he wrote, 2 weeks before he died, he completed the Christic, which is tucked into the set of essays called The Heart of Matter and the volume of his latest writings. But he explains, he does it autobiographically, which always makes things a little bit more accessible and more persuasive in a way. He's already given us a clue in the very end of the human phenomenon, when he first inserts this bombshell that the omega point is Christ. And he says, pardon, 209 in Human Phenomenon. This will be a brief thing. He says that if this was merely a theory, it wouldn't stand. But if, on the other hand, as we have admitted, omega already exists and is at work right here and now in the deepest part of the thinking mass, then it seems inevitable that there would be some observable signs of its existence here and now. And he takes off from there with the assumption that one of the ways that he's going to ground this seeing that he has is with the fact that this is not just speculation. This is based on the riveting understanding that this Christ, you know, he's met this Christ force, this Christ principle, as an actual entity and presence in his own being. So that's basically the point in the essay, the Christic. He starts out by about page 82, I'm reading in The Heart of Matter. He describes that through his whole life, there have been two principles leading, which he calls a cosmic convergence and a Christic emergence. And they both have two dimensions to them. On the most simple and straight up, cosmic convergence means he became more and more sure, by virtue of his scientific training, by virtue of his calculations, by everything that he's laid out in the human phenomenon, that evolution dictated that there needed to be a point. If evolution is convergent, then there needs to be a point at which all lines converge. And that became for him the omega point. And remember that as the way he derived that, thinking-wise, is that that things only are forced to articulate and self-organize when they're put under the pressure of convergence. In other words, in empty space, they just float on out individuating in a vacuum. It's only under the pressure of confinement that they are forced to get organized. You know. So that for him is a fundamental principle. We've looked at how he sees that the very shape of the Earth and its gravitational field forces things together and eventually is going to take all these little bits and pieces of atomized consciousnesses and fuse them into a single instrument of a far higher magnitude. We've looked at how he sees that. We've looked at how he scientifically derives it. But here he adds in the dimension that he actually sees it. That she says that one of the lines in his own life that closes on him, and during the course of my life there has gradually been around me, until it has become habitual, the capacity to see two movements. On the one hand, there has been the irresistible convergence of my individual thought with every other thinking being of the earth, and in consequence, with everything that is going through a gradual process of arrangement, whatever it be, to whatever degree, in the immensity of time and space. This was sort of the revelation that came on him, particularly during his time in the trenches of World War I, when he was about 25 to 30, when suddenly the whole kind of cosmic function opened up in him. And he felt himself absolutely grillingly to be part of a collective body of humankind with a weight and a heft and a density. We'll be celebrating that when we offer the Mass on the World tonight. This vision of the global oneness emerging not out of some nice little happy idea he knits, but out of a visceral sense as he stood as a stretcher bearer in the trenches, bathed in the blood of his platoon, which is mostly Algerian Muslims, and in the midst of this extraordinary atrocity of World War I, this senseless, pointless carnage, he's swept away by this overwhelming vision that things are converging towards the triumphant proclamation, you know, of the unity of all human beings. He's one of the very first to name and feel that unity. And he feels it not on the basis of some happy-dappy feeling, but of, you can almost say he feels himself under the centrifugal pressure of this convergent machine of evolution, and out of that he senses the emergence of this next layer of higher collectivity, whichever after in his mind will be identified with him, with the Pleroma, or the mystical body of Christ. And over and over, he makes it clear in his writings, particularly in his book, The Divine Milieu, that he senses this not only as a possibility, but as an actual active energetic field. Already now, bearing on this earth with its own particular causality, and if we know how to tangle with it, offering assistance, support, help, and contexting. That's the whole point of his The Divine Milieu book, which he wrote in 1926. It's one of the white hot pieces of this vision. But it's the vision that steered him ever after. It's a vision that I kind of lay out in my imaginal book, that this is not this imaginal realm, this other, this divine milieu, this higher point of vision is not just a speculative geometric supposition. It's an actual palpable force field that's pushing us together. And I think that you would have to be daft to say that Teilhard was not actually feeling this, but only just sort of extrapolating it. You can see in every way he writes, in the place he writes from, that this is bearing on him as a primordial existential truth of his being. So the other thing that he does, conversely, is he says that all this while that this is going on, this great grandiose vision of the impending unity of all humankind at the next evolutionary level, something else is happening to him. That in his heart, deep within his own individuated being, he is meeting the radiant presence of the risen Christ. And he's meeting it, again, not as a hypothetical possibility, but as an actual energy field, which in a paradoxical way draws him deeper and deeper into his own self. He calls it a supercentration, which is a term that I can unpack from the time in the work in circles just like this, those moments when something enters where you come qualitatively deeper into yourself and you realize that, oh, here I am. The emergence of real I, the emergence of something of a qualitatively different order of reality. And he talks about it. He says, on the other side, there has been the persistent individualization at the center of my own small ego of an ultra-center of thought and action. In the depths of my consciousness, the rise, which nothing can stop, of a sort of other who would be even more than I am myself. He describes, again you'll find the essay recorded in The Heart of Matter, of a first kind of mystical encounter with this in a church in France. He probably had many others. But where he meets the risen Christ, not as a pretty little, you know, golden boy coming in to rescue him, but as an energy field emanating from his heart, from which for the rest of his life, He ascribes the colors crimson and gold. It's a force flowing out from his heart that completely galvanizes and transfigures his being. So you have these two lines of bearing on what he's seeing. And the certainty of the intimate presence of this risen Christ as a force field directing his own evolution, his own journey into this other sphere of reality, is utterly real in him, utterly visceral, such to the end that it's the last thing that he can say, that since I've sought you all my life, when death finally closes my eyes, I will have the present pleasure, you know, the honor of stepping into it fully. You know, it becomes his magnetic center, for sure. So, the other question about this, he's spoken his own truth here, powerfully, that this is the sources of it. And what we don't see, you have to kind of connect the dots here, that That Teilhard was a Jesuit, which means that he would have learned Ignatian patterns of prayer, which are very discursive, which really use that self-reflective property of consciousness to stand outside of yourself and look at my life and where am I going and what relationship to God am I, and it's a wonderful tool of inquiry from that perspective. But you don't see very many Jesuits that transform in the direction that Teilhard transformed. I think there was a different element. And that has to do with his lifelong devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, which is a particular, peculiar kind of French piety. That's where this devotional cult got started, and is generally exercised and manifested on essentially a magic level of consciousness. And if you ever drive around French Canada, you see it particularly well, those 12-foot-high alabaster statues of Jesus with the little red heart in the middle of it dripping a couple of drops of blood. That's the kind of folk iteration of it. But what Teilhard learned on his mother's knees, literally, was to practice this devotion of sensing the Sacred Heart of Jesus in his own heart. And my take on the whole matter is that Teilhard, who as far as we know never bumped into the Eastern Orthodox tradition of Christianity in any kind of substantive external way, was nonetheless found his own way to the practice of putting the mind in the heart. And the fact that his images of this all have to do with fire suggests to me that he got it. And in a funny and partial way, but good enough, he did what is required to move beyond the complete gravitational field of egoic rational consciousness into the opening up of this other possibility of perception. And so, not knowing what he did, not knowing how he did it, trying to contextualize everything he knew from worlds beyond worlds and from dimensions beyond dimensions within the tools of the intellectual structure that he was born into and educated into. This accounts for this funny little bungee jumping between the realms that you find is characteristic of all of Teilhard's thinking. You know, he's a, as I say, a ternary swan in a binary duck pond. And when he drops a level and goes back to the old techniques that he's learned for processing reality by extrapolating his thinking to a point like plane geometry, Euclidean mode, that's where error, confusion enters his work. When he's actually seeing from the heart of Christ, he's seeing by the classic methodology of revelation. And I'm inclined to trust it. It doesn't mean that I have to believe everything that he says, because the whole essence is you can't believe what somebody else says. You have to take the cues, and if you're interested in engaging with it, inquire into how this might live in yourself. So ultimately you see for yourself as you open the gates to wrestling with it. But I think that he's bringing us back a genuine seeing that emerges from a different dimension, from the new structure emerging on the horizon. And you can almost catch that at the very end of this essay that still breaks my heart. And I've alluded to this before. At the end, this man 73 years old, exiled in New York City in winter, in exiled by a church to which he's given his life, forbidden from writing, you know, out of it, essentially in isolation, writes, "How is it then that as I look around me, still dazzled by what I have seen, I find that I am almost the only person of my kind, the only one to have seen. How is it, you know, when I'm swept away by this vision, by this palpable sense, you know, the encounter with the origin, in which the unanimity, the diversification within unity of the body of humanity is effected in the mystical body of Christ. How when I see that? I look around and nobody else sees to see it." And the desperate loneliness driving him back to the question, am I deluded? And he sits there, and for the last two pages of this, he ponders, have I just been smoking weed? But then he comes up with this. He says, everywhere on earth at this moment, in the new spiritual atmosphere created by the appearance of the idea of evolution, there float, in a state of extreme mutual sensitivity, love of God and faith in the world, the two essential components of the ultra-human. These two components are everywhere in the air. Generally, however, they are not strong enough, both at the same time, to combine with one another in one and the same subject. In me, it happens by pure chance, temperament, upbringing, background, that the proportion of the one to the other is correct, and that the fusion of the two has been effected spontaneously, not as yet with sufficient force to spread explosively, but strong enough nevertheless to make it clear that the process is possible and that sooner or later there will be a chain reaction. You know, and he's touched this in the human phenomenon many times. He says, as soon as a mutation appears anywhere on the earth, it's spontaneously there everywhere. You see it in China, then you see it in Africa. You know, and it's not like the people from China could have migrated to Africa. It's like non-localized action. When origin bursts into time, it has that scatter pattern. David Burma and the other great physicists have told us more about that. But remember that Teilhard was ahead of the curve on that too. And then the last, this is one more proof that truth has to appear only once in one single mind for it to be impossible for anything ever to prevent it from spreading universally and setting everything ablaze. The last word he writes, ablaze. What can you do? So here we are, the second wave, the pandemic, the toppling of structures and structures and structures of a late deficient rational stranglehold on consciousness. The despair that the liberal progressive establishment feels, whether it's religious or postmodern secular, that the things so precious to us are being wantonly destroyed. The sense of abandonment, of betrayal, of disorientation, all there. And if you can hold the big picture, that this is the inevitable, in some sense, fallout, as this new already in our midst emerges even more forcefully to the surface as the evolutionary current. And even holding that picture a little is a source of hope and reorientation. It also scares you shitless, because to hang on to that signal, to hang on to that, really requires the stabilization of a new sense in ourself that we don't reliably have, and that our strongest crutch, our thinking, is actively blocking, you know? And I think that was some of the heart cry in your question last night, Vesta. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to do it, but we can't. Mm-hmm. We're caught between two worlds, literally. But the map allows us to receive some sort of consolation that we're not doing it all ourselves. That there is an evolutionary current, maybe 14 billion years old, kind of sweeping through this. And that the real call is not to doubt and scratch our heads, but to take the humility and the humilification of the fact that we don't know this other yet. But we can sense it. We have intimations of it because origin is in us. Each one of us, as Thomas Keating liked to say, is an individual big bang flowing out from origin. We recapitulate this. We know it. We recognize it. And it's more a matter of deconstruction and remembering Gurdjieff's thinking that once the three centers are there and working, the other just yearns to give itself unto us. It's not playing hide and seek. It's not passive. So we can start somewhere. And in the humility to start somewhere, and a different somewhere than our culture has for 2,500 years pointed out is the proper starting place. We will find help joining us, and I think this is the cry of hope that feeds through this. The other part about this that I don't want to dwell on, and if we don't get all the way done with it this afternoon, we can pick it up this afternoon, because it's going to flow pretty smoothly into Gurdjieff's take on the whole thing, is that the cost of this, that this is bought at enormous suffering. And people are, you know, people who talk about Teilhard's glib optimism just have never stood in his shoes. This is a man who suffered disproportionately, who took on himself burdens that didn't need to be contracted. And one of the most you know, powerful and frustrating of them for many people is to say, why did he stay with the church? You know, a church which continued to shaft and betray him. He had a complete setup. I mean, instantly he could have simply renounced his orders, taken a position at any university anywhere in the world, married if he had so desired, published anything he wanted. The crew would have lionized him. He would have had the opportunity to interact with some of the great thinkers that were emerging in his age. He might very well have lived another decade or so, because it's fairly sure he died of a broken heart. But he didn't. He had this deep interior sense that his vows must not be broken, and that in some sense they were the source of the purity and the agency of all he did. And so he willingly took on extraordinary personal suffering as the cost of, as he saw it, maintaining the connection with this profound seeing from the other dimension. And it's inscrutable. If you read his love letters with Lucille Swan, he was fighting his own nature in many, many ways, his gregarious nature, his social nature, and no one could ever understand. They say, you're being stupid. And to these days, you can still sit on the fence and discuss. We had a lovely discussion at the dinner table on Tuesday night. Was this intentional suffering or stupid suffering? Was this real conscience or acquired conscience? Terms I'm going to be talking about more this afternoon. In other words, was he just doing this because he was so conditioned by the education and cultural expectations of his time that he couldn't wriggle out from them? In other words, was he a stupid martyr? Or did he actually make this as a free gift of his being and take on a burden that was more than his to carry individually? Out of a conscious higher altruism. I think that the answer can't be definitively known. I mean, it's one of these things that you wrestle with in your own heart. But I do know that he has, amongst his others, a very short essay that was written, probably as an on-demand piece that's in his activation of energy book called The Spiritual Energy of Suffering. And for most of it, he's just doing the kind of expected things of saying, oh, suffering is redeemed when you bear it with Christian cheerfulness and virtue. It was an on-demand piece for a community that was essentially a hospice community of nuns. But there's something else he sees. And a couple of places, he starts it with this very fascinating view of this long, long, long view. Let's see, back here, Spiritual Energy of Suffering, 245. What page did I get on? There it is. Where he says, if a perfectly keen-eyed observer were to watch the earth for a long time from a great height, our planet would first of all appear to him blue from the oxygen that envelops it, then green from the vegetation which covers it, then luminous and ever more luminous from the thought that grows in intensity on its surface. But at the same time, it would appear dark, and even more dark, from a suffering that throughout the ages grows in quantity and poignancy in step with the rise of consciousness. So he's already seeing it as a volume. And he says, and if only too, through the medium of some conductivity suddenly established between bodies and souls, all the pain were mixed with all the joy of the world, who can say on what side the balance would settle? On that of pain or that of joy? Hold that thought, because we're going to pick it up with Gurdjieff this afternoon. Then he goes on, and of course, one of the facts of his life is that suffering surrounded his family. He, of course, lost a few brothers in the First World War, but it became really kind of incarnated from him in his sister Marguerite, who became bedridden for something which is most usually described as an extreme complication of what we now call lupus, and became more and more dysfunctional. And he has the sense even then that latent in suffering, it can be transformed into another dimension. And he has this haunting final paragraph. O Marguerite, my sister, while I, given body and soul to the positive forces of the universe, was wandering over continents and oceans, my whole being passionately taken up in watching the rise of all the earth's tints and shades, you lay motionless, stretched out on your bed of sickness, silently, deep within you, yourself, you were transforming into light the world's most grievous shadows. In the eyes of the Creator, which one of us, tell me, which one of us will have had the better part? Look at that image for the moment. He's out there gallivanting around, you know, climbing rocks, discovering continents, discovering Paleolithic fossils. She is under the most intense confinement, bedridden. And yet he senses that deep within you are transforming into light that collective suffering, that collective pain body. In that statement, he's gotten far beyond, well, let's bear our sufferings cheerfully for Christ. He's understanding that there is a transformative power latent in suffering. And when suffering can be cleanly and voluntarily embraced, something is released which, in a way, which in a real way, changes the composition of the planet, affects the whole, or as Gurdjieff would say, extends beyond our individual portion to lighten the sorrow of our common Father. And it's this dimension that we're going to return to this afternoon as we look at Gurdjieff's teaching on conscience. But for now, to hold and to begin to work in your own being the inextricable link between conscious, voluntary suffering and the emergence of this other faculty of seeing, this other perspective for a fresh start. And just to hold that and inquire about that in your own life as we move through the day. We'll see where the afternoon leaves us. So, yes, Deborah.
I forgot to do after the morning sitting.
Oh, the morning task. Okay, what is our task, my dear?
Well, what just comes naturally to me is to come back to the breath and to come back to some semblance of the exercise, whether it's just breathing or feeling of Lord have mercy, if that's all you can do, or if you can combine the Gospodi and the Lord have mercy, then do that. But just come back to the feeling here and meaning of those words as you breathe in and breathe out, sensing the body.
Great. Along those lines. Great. And I'd like to add to that another flourish for any who so wish to. If you find yourself outside and it happens to be raining, let the raindrop falling upon you call you into remembrance of the tears of our common Father. Господи, победы. That being said, we have some announcements about the rest of the day and little organizational things. Let's see if we can get through this without scrambling attention. Okay. First of all, is there going to be outdoor work today?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Prepare accordingly, men and women. Okay. Second, due to the nature of the weather forecast and also due to the need for a greater recollection at the end of the day, we're going to do our commemoration, our Mass on the World and our our commemoration of the passing of Mr. Gurdjieff here, not down in the barn. Okay, we're doing that at least partially because it just didn't feel right, the ending, if we do it down in the barn. People are either going to be then getting in their cars and driving back here in the rain, or else stumbling along in the dark. And it seemed everything that we were going to do will fit in this room. And it will allow us to contain whatever is generated here without losing it in logistical arrangements. So we will be here. We will do movements this afternoon in the barn. Good luck. Let the rain drench you in the tears of our common Father. You know, prepare as you can, drive as you will. At least we stay there. And those that are involved in the Mass, Jonathan, Ben, and Andrew principally, will meet here right after lunch about... Oh, we can keep an eye on each other. We aren't a big thing, but let's say if we lose our thread, we'll meet here by 1:10 or so at the latest to essentially run it and try some logistics. Okay.
Anyone that doesn't want to do outdoor work, there's a group that's going to be organizing the library in the barn. So see Amy or myself in the lobby.
Okay, anything else? Okay, all worded upward then.